Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on outcomes and likelihoods when we come back. Hey, if you're earning about $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets 60%. Now, that's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Well, now, isn't that just real special? And if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government will net 75%, which means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net about $4,000 more, or 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. You produce twice as much and get 8% of it. And that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS, by the way. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only get 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order our free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information. It answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is we're paying so much and receiving so little. Let me show you how to do just that in our Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. If you're online, you can go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Why don't you do right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Well, in looking at current events, I see that the number one current event being discussed by everybody is the economic collapse. And more we hear the big D word. It's the deflation, deflation, deflation. Followed by the second big D word, which is depression, depression, depression. And indeed, all of the numbers are grim. There's no doubt about that. In fact, William Buckler used the word breathtaking. In my historical research, my observation was that the last Great Depression, from the beginning, that is the stock market collapse in October of 1929 until the banks were closed in March, it was March 6th of 1933, about a 3.5 year period there, it took 3.5 years to reach the bottom. Now, so far we've been engaged in this thing for 1.5 years and there's no bottom in sight. It reminds me of an airplane that's in a nosedive headed straight down at full power. The unemployment numbers, if you've been watching, in October were about 500,000, November 500,000, December 500,000, January 500,000. Then they revised them and all the numbers went up by about 100,000. In fact, they're all about 600,000. Then they're talking about 3.6 million jobs lost through the calendar year 2008 and an unemployment rate when you consider all of the unemployed. That's not just the people that are drawing unemployment this week or initial new claims or the people that have been on it for a month or two. Unemployment insurance over a long period of time, 13 to 26 weeks, runs out. And the presumption is that when your unemployment runs out, you now have a job. You're employed. So they take you off the unemployed rolls. That's why the unemployment rolls are showing about 7.5% unemployed. When in reality, there's a bunch of people out there that have been unemployed for a long time. They can't find employment, and their unemployment ran out. Now, they don't count those. And then they don't count people that are underemployed. So if you're a nuclear physicist and you're working at McDonald's flipping burgers, you're not counted as unemployed. Hell, you're counted as fully employed because you're getting minimum wage. So anybody that's getting minimum wage is fully employed. There's another group of people out here that aren't working 40 hours a week. They're working 32 hours a week. They don't count those people as being partially unemployed, underemployed. They count those people as being fully employed also. I mean, after all, you got a job. What the hell are you bitching about? Now, when you add all of these people together, it's called U6. And it's the U6 number. And it runs 17.5% when you count them all together. Maximum unemployment, which counted unemployment by this U6 modality back in 1933, was around 20%, which finally hit 25% in 1937. So after all the stimulus packages were put together by the Roosevelt administration from 33 to 37, unemployment went up 5 percentage points. And when you take a look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average and you take a look at the fall in commodities and the whole nine yards, the maximum fall in the stock market was 89%. Well, we haven't reached 89% yet, but commodities during the last Great Depression dropped off about 40%. So far, commodities are off 50%. So when we're looking at the numbers, it looks like that this is indeed a depression, not recession. And there is a deflation going on, but at the very same time that prices, like for gasoline and commodities, which had run up to astronomical new highs, and now they've fallen off their new highs, and now they're back down to where they belong. For instance, let me take a look at one here. When 2000 came along, let's just go back here about 8-9 years. In 2000, the price of copper was 80 cents a pound. Well, during the Bush years, the price of copper up through July of 2008 hit $3.52. So it went from 8, 16, 24, 32. So it went up 400%. Okay? Now that's called inflation. Now from July of 2008, the price of copper has gone down to, yesterday it was $1.53. So if you take a look at the price of copper, from 2000 through last night, the price of copper has just about doubled. In other words, it went from 80 cents to $1.60, $1.55 or $1.53. Nobody calls that inflation. They call it deflation because it went down from July of 2008 until February of 2009. It's gone down from $3.52 to $1.55. So they're calling this deflation. Well, that's true. It's deflated from its high, but it's not deflated. It's actually inflated by double. And that's where reality's at here, kids. Well, it's either that or the value of your money over the last 8 years has dropped in half. The purchasing power of your money is going down at the same time that commodities are going up. Now, we saw this with gasoline. When this thing with gasoline started to take off, the price of gas when Bush came into office around my neck of the woods here was a little over $1 a gallon. It was about $1.10. And then during the Bush years, it hit $4 a gallon. And so Everybody says, oh my God, that was terrible inflation. Went from $1 to $4 a gallon. I went to town yesterday and I saw the price of gas was at $1.79. So it's dropped from $4 to $2. And so it's gone down by half. And so we're going through this god-awful deflation. And now our government's telling us we've got to solve this deflationary problem. Now, boys and girls, the truth of the matter is we don't have a deflationary problem. There never has been. That's a red herring. You have an inflation problem. The difference between 2000 and today is that the inflation today is less than it was last July. It's true. The inflation is less than it was last July, but you're still suffering from inflation. Furthermore, your government between October, we go back to September, I guess, September the 19th, I think, is when Paulson went to Nancy Pelosi and said, we got this god-awful problem. And they have now doubled the money supply. Well, when the money supply doubles, what does that do to the value of the money that was in circulation prior to that? Well, it drops its purchasing power in half over time. And the time runs from about 6 to 24 months. Now, the general rule of thumb is they try to figure around 6 to 18 months. You're going to see some price changes. Right at the moment, the price changes that we see are going down, called deflation. And the value of your dollar is going up. It went from about 72 to about 85. Yesterday it was 85.5 cents, 85.5. And so everybody's saying, well, the value of the dollar is going up and the prices are going down. This is dangerous. And what we need is a stimulus package. And so the president's out now selling this stimulus package. And Franklin Sanders in the Money Changer, this is the Money Changer now for January 2009, January issue, wrote an article here called Likelihoods. Likelihoods. What do you think is likely to occur over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months? And I thought it was a pretty good article because I'm getting telephone calls just like Franklin is. And Franklin Sanders, now remember, he's a paid professional with letters after his name, and I'm just a plumber. And so I kind of rely upon what we used to call in the old days common sense. My old dad used to say, you know, that guy ain't got a lick of sense. He hasn't got a lick of common sense. Or my granny used to say, that guy hasn't got sense enough to carry guts to a barrel. There were just certain things in life, you know, that were givens, and you should know that the guts belong in the barrel over there, and you should have at least a lick of sense. Now, we go to college, and we learn things. See, we get smart. We get educated. So they want to send us off here to college and get us educated. And I'm beginning to take a dim view of this higher education, because what I see coming out of these institutions are fools with papers that can't carry guts to a barrel. And I suppose you're probably looking around seeing the same thing. Let's take a look here at these economists. Now, the economists are running around telling us that the bottom's in sight and everything's going to be fine and don't you worry about a thing. And the president says, hey, we got a long road to hoe, but we're going to get there. Kind of like Martin Luther King. And he said, you know, I might not get there with you, but we're going to get there to the promised land. So I like to take a look at reality. Can you get there from here? As the old adage goes, you know, and sometimes they'll say, well, you can't get there from here. That means that isn't going to happen. That's an impossibility. So they're talking about borrowing money and stimulating the economy. And the president's out here selling an $800 billion package. Now, I'm an old man. You young people out there, you can't remember back to the Eisenhower administration. You weren't around then. I was. And here's what I've observed firsthand. I was there, and I listened to a Huntley Brinkley report, and I was watching it as it was occurring. I have never yet seen an estimate come out of any governmental agency that was correct. And if there was one, I don't deny it. I missed it. But I watch pretty carefully. And they don't miss it on the low side. I have never seen an estimate come out of Washington or Sacramento or Jefferson City or Tallahassee that ever came out under budget. They always come out over budget, and most often by about double. And it just to take you back to what you can remember. Do you remember that when the Iraq War started? Now, this is five years ago now. George Bush and company said this Iraq War will be over in short order and cost $50 billion. Do you remember that number? $50 billion. That's what they're selling. Went into Congress and said this is what we need. Now, so far, that Iraq War has cost $1 trillion. Not a dime of it's been paid for with a nickel's worth of tax yet. It's all borrowed money. Now, the estimates for the overall cost of this Iraq War, which isn't even over yet, you know, they're winding it down. People are getting tired of that one. They've got to have a new war. We'll need something new here pretty shortly. We're going to wind this one down. The last time I saw an estimate as to what the overall long-term costs are going to be, see, if you borrow $1 trillion and you pay interest on it at 5%, see, that means that you gotta pay interest on this for the next God only knows how many years, because we've never paid off any debt here in this country since 1836. So this debt just continues on forever, accumulating interest. But assuming that you were going to pay this off over the next 30 years, it's going to cost you people $4 trillion to do that. That's if you get after it. So the Iraq War didn't cost $50 billion, it cost $4 trillion, you know, over the next 30 years. But, you know, they don't count that way. They don't say, well, it's going to cost us $4 trillion over the next 30 years. They say, well, the debt's $1 trillion, so it's a little bit over budget, you know, about 20 times what they had originally estimated. Now, that's an extreme example. They don't always miss it, you know, by 20 times. But I just wanted to bring it to your attention that I, at my age of 70, I have never seen one of these estimates come out on budget. They're always over. This is an extreme. It's over by 20. Normally, they're under guessing it by about half. Anytime government tells you it's going to cost you this much, just double that, and that'll put you close to it. Well, it'll put you closer to it. So this $800 billion stimulus package is going to cost you double that, at least, and probably more. Then by the time you pay the interest on it over the next 30 years, that $800 billion is going to multiply by 4, see, because you got to pay the interest. And this interest doubles and doubles the principal. Did you know that? It's called the Rule of 72. All right, so now with that in mind, Franklin Sanders wrote an article here in the paper. I thought I'd share it with you because I think he hit the nail pretty much on the head. He said, recently two men drove a long way to talk with me about the current economic situation and how to plan for the future. And while we were talking, I realized that they were trying to make decisions while giving equal weight to all of the possible outcomes. But all possible outcomes are not equally likely. So we do not need to prepare for all possible outcomes equally. Preparing for all likely outcomes equally means that you end up concentrating too much on the unlikely outcomes. Because our resources are limited, we cannot prepare for everything equally. Now, as a new year and a new regime begin, we ought to consider what outcomes are most likely so that we can plan rationally for the future. And I looked at that and I said, now, by God, now that makes sense. That's just common sense. There's in my experience, there's usually about four possible outcomes. There's four ways to do anything. You know, you want to go to Disneyland or Disney World, you know, down in Florida. Well, there's a lot of different roads that lead to Orlando, Florida. You don't have to follow the freeway. You could follow the backcountry roads, the county roads. You could fly down there. You could take the train down there. You know, you could take the Greyhound buses. There's a number of ways for you to get there. And so we start thinking about, well, how fast do we need to get there? Well, you know, if you've got a weekend and you take the train and it takes 5 days to get there, it's pretty obvious that that isn't going to work. And so, you know, we start thinking about, well, gee, maybe we better fly. Because if we fly, well, but if you fly, it's going to cost you a lot more. And we don't have enough money, maybe, to fly. We got enough money to take the train, but we haven't got enough time. But if we fly, that'll give us enough time, but we don't have enough money. Are there any other possible outcomes? You know, you start thinking about the possible outcomes. And pretty soon, maybe we can't go to Disneyland or Disney World. Maybe we have to go to Six Flags over at St. Louis. Maybe we have to drive. You know, and so there are different possible outcomes that come from our initial thinking. And my observation tells me there's about four ways to do that. There's the best way. That's the cheapest and fastest. That's the one we all want. And then there's the fourth best way. That's the slowest and most expensive. But there's a bright side to the fourth best way. It does indeed get the job done. The first best way gets the job done the fastest and the cheapest, and the fourth best way gets it done the slowest with the most expense. Both work, both get the job done. Well, naturally, we would like to have the first best way, but now in the process of trying to select the best way, we have differences of opinion. One guy looks at the problem and he says, well, here's what I think. Second guy looks at the problem and he says, well, I don't quite see it that way, but here's what I see as the outcome. Third guy looks at it and he's got something different altogether. Fourth guy, maybe he's got a little different twist on it. That's been my observation over the years. You put the same problem in front of four people and you get four different solutions, four different takes on it. It's true they may agree on a point or two or five, but in the final analysis, I've never seen any two people ever come to the same conclusion faced with exactly the same facts. In fact, they do this quite often. You know, some tax guy will take the identical same tax return, the exact same papers, the exact same inputs, and take it to four different tax preparers and get four different answers. How in the hell do you do that? If you were an engineer, you know, and you were sitting here trying to figure out the load on a bridge, and you took it to four engineers and got four different answers, you know, we'd say there was something wrong here. Every one of those engineers should come up with exactly the same answer if you have exactly the same input. A mathematician, you know, that takes the same numbers and comes up with four different answers over here, there's something wrong here. But in life, when you're trying to figure out, well, how should I deal with this great tribulation coming on? This is Bible prophecy now, you know. You talk to religious people, and my God, they've got ideas from the rapture to we got to go dig a hole in the ground and hide ourselves to don't do anything to, you know, they've got opinions and ideas as to what ought to be done. And since there's about 476 religious groups, these are the religious groups that are recorded with the government and have tax exemptions, 476 of them, last time I saw a number. And they've all got 476 different ideas as to how to accomplish that goal. Now, you and I come in on the program over here, and we're trying to figure this out. And I don't care what it is. It could be the upcoming depression or recession or whatever you want to call it, or stimulus package and so on. In Washington, you've got all of these people in Congress, you know, the Republicans are saying, hey, this thing isn't going to employ anybody and it's going to cost a lot of money. And the Democrats are saying it's going to employ, you know, 4 million people, and it's a hell of a good program, and it's, and $800 billion isn't near enough. We ought to double it. Well, that's good thinking, because, you know, if you've got something over here that's really good, I always figure twice as much has got to be twice as good, or don't you? So if I thought that $800 billion was going to employ 4 million people, well, wouldn't 1.6 trillion employ 8 million people, and wouldn't 8 million Americans being employed be twice as good or a better outcome than just 4 million? Of course, then the other side says over there, you're going to spend $800 billion over here and you ain't going to employ very many people, you know, maybe 500,000 or. And then they take a look at the cost for this. Now, this $800 billion, remember, is going to multiply times 4. So if you take 800 times 4, that would be 3.2 trillion. So if you employ 4 million people with this 800 billion, are you going to make $3.2 trillion back so that you can pay the interest on this debt? Because if the answer is no, then this isn't a very good deal. And I'm not sure that these politicians are trained well enough in business to come up with a profitable outcome. Let me give you another illustration here. The President Bush program called for $700 billion, which they had to inflate to $800 billion. So we've already gone through an $800 billion stimulus plan. See, we've tested this already. We did it last October. So far, they spent half of it, $350 billion, and not 10 cents of that $350 billion has gone to one single taxpayer making under $100,000 a year. And if it has, send me a letter and tell me who got it, who got the dime. So far, it's the first $350 billion went to bail out banks. So Bank of America got a bunch, and Citigroup got a bunch, and a bunch of bankers over here got a bunch, and then they took the money and went out and consolidated and bought some other banks. And hell, I'm not here to criticize it. Maybe that was a good program. I just wanted to tell you that so far you spent half. Now Gaither, the new Secretary of the Treasury, is getting ready to spend the other $350. And so far they don't know where the first $350 went. They've been asking questions. Well, where did you spend that $350? Nobody's talking. So you spent half of the $700 billion, which actually cost $800. See, $700 of it goes to the banks as a stimulus. $100 billion of it was pork to buy the votes to get the thing passed. And doesn't make any difference. Bottom line is that you're on the hook and you got to pay this $8. Now, this $8 that we've already borrowed has to be financed over the next 30 years. And if you're going to finance it over the next 30 years, it's going to cost you $3.2 trillion, which in the past has never been paid off. So at the end of 60 years, it's going to cost you another, oh my God, $12.8 trillion. Over 60 years, $12.8 trillion. I mean, you know, as old Everett Dirksen used to say, you know, a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. You know, a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon we're starting to talk about real money. So the first stimulus package passed last October has produced zero results for job creation and stimulus, as is evidenced by the fact that jobs haven't stabilized. They're accelerating. The loss of jobs, you know, which was 400,000 in September, reached up to 500,000 in October, which was revised to 580,000 after they got to counting good again. See, well, after somebody took off his shoes and got to getting some toes out there, figured out they undercounted. And so I saw a number the other day, was it 580,000, pushing 600,000 here for January of 2009. So the unemployment rate is increasing, it's not decreasing. And that was your first 800. Now the president's out here, he's going to sell us another 800. Well, excuse me, children, but if the first 800 didn't work, what in the hell makes you think the second 800 is going to do any better? And when we look back in history, the money that the Roosevelt people spent didn't work either. And that's the model that they're trying to emulate. I know you went to school and they told you that Roosevelt was a miracle worker and he walked on water and saved us from the Depression. Well, I actually went back and took a look at the numbers, and that's not what the numbers tell us. Numbers tell us that it was a total failure. Total. Not partial. Not half. Just total. Didn't work. Period. Now, it is true we need a stimulus package. But not because it's going to put anybody to work. We need it because it's a psychological boost. Now, Roosevelt did do that. He made people feel a lot better. That's very important when you're running for re-election in 2010 and 2012. People have to feel good. And what people feel best about is when you're out working hard and trying. The correct response to this economic crisis is to do nothing. Zero. Let the companies that can make it, and those that can't make it go broke. And the people that invested in the bad companies lose their money. Nobody wants that to happen, so we're going to do something, even if it's wrong. So we get busy and we do something, and that makes people feel better. Now, in the process, it's going to make the Depression last much longer, probably three times. Now, we had a Depression from 1783 to about 1787. And the solution then was to get off of paper, shut down the banks, and go back to gold and silver coin. And in 36 months, it turned around. Now, the second time we tried this, we went to paper, caused the Depression, put out more paper, and the Depression lasted for 12 years. And so this is the third round. And we're going to emulate what we did the second time. So that says to me we're probably going to get the same kind of conclusion that we got the second time around. And after all, that's what Franklin Sanders is pointing out. He says likelihoods. What's likely to be in our future if we take course A? Well, my common sense says, since we're going to follow the same failed policies of 1933, we're probably going to get the same result that we got in 1933. Only President Obama says we're going to double, triple, or quadruple the amount of stimulus that we used in the 1930s. Well, now the signal it says to me, since the failure of the 1930s produced 100, if we were to double that, we should get double the amount of failure this time around. And if we really want to get after it and we quadruple it, then we should get four times the failure this time that we got the last time. How do you like that? For what we used to call on the street common sense. All right, it's the halfway point here, boys and girls, and we have to give you a reminder here to satisfy all of the governmental agencies around the world. We try hard. I've got to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. and the law. Our website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. So keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a story in The Money Changer. Let me tell you where you can get a copy of The Money Changer in case you like the story. We haven't got to the story yet, but you might like it. It's the January 2009 edition of The Money Changer put out by Franklin Sanders. And they live at Post Office Box 178 in West Point, Tennessee. And the zip code is 38486. And they also have a telephone number. It's 888, and I believe that's toll-free, 888-218-9226. You got to write that down. This guy Franklin Sanders is a pretty good old boy. I like his paper. It's unique. It's a newsletter, and he's an economist. And he's a gold broker, and I guess that's about all I can tell you that's positive about him. And other than that, I don't know too much more about him. He's got a unique outlook on things, and I kind of like it. He's old like I am, probably a little cantankerous, and he's a pretty common sense kind of guy. He's a farmer. He has a farm, and he's a self sufficient farmer, and he puts out articles from time to time on agriculture. Probably subscribes to Acres USA, which is I do. And he's got a cow or two. He milks a cow, and he thinks that things are bad and getting a lot worse. And that's what I think. I think things are bad and getting a lot worse. But I'll tell you what I really like about this guy. He's got some good practical solutions. Well, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to live through this? How am I going to survive this? Where I'm at. And what is the likely outcome? And I like this article here because, you know, what is the likelihood that this is going to occur that way? Which is, you know, I'm just like all the rest of you guys out there. I'm interested in somebody else's opinion. I think here's what's going to happen. And here Sanders comes along and says, well, here's what I think is going to happen. And the next guy comes along, you know, this may be William Buckler down in Queensland, Australia. He says, well, here's what I think is going to happen. And there's a scripture in the Bible that tells you that there's safety in a multitude of counsel. There is safety. It comes from the book of Proverbs, where it comes from. There's safety in a multitude of counsel. So what you do is you get three or four guys together, and you just kind of sit down, shut up, and listen to this guy as he expounds as to what he's thinking. Here's a guy that reads history books, and he's pretty familiar with what happened in the Roman Empire, and pretty familiar with what happened to Alexander in Greece. And you know, here's what happened in the 1930s, and he publishes those facts. And he says, you know, based upon what I see here and what I see there. For instance, let me give you an illustration. You got people out here that say the Roosevelt years were total success, the greatest thing since sliced white bread solved the problem, and that's what we need to do again. The reality of it was a total failure. Nothing worked. It was very confidence-inspiring. And Roosevelt was a great con man, made us all feel real good, but none of his policies worked. And so we want to do that again. So it sends me a signal. It says, well, if you failed by 100% last time and you quadruple it, you should fail by four times that this time around. So that's what I'm looking for, about a four times failure. That says that this depression is going to be four times worse than the last round. Now, I'm prepared for the last depression. In fact, I just told my last class that. I said, I'm fully prepared for the last depression. But if this new depression is going to be four times worse than the last one, then I'm probably only 25% prepared. Then I got to thinking about that and said, no, I've already doubled what I thought I was going to need to solve the last depression problem. Which means that if it's four times worse than the last time, then I'm only half prepared. Half. All right. Now, I'm looking at my position, and I say, no, if I'm half prepared, and most of the people that I deal with aren't prepared at all. They have no plans whatsoever other than the Obama stimulus package of making any changes in their lifestyles whatsoever. In fact, I had a guy here the other day. I got to tell you a story. The power went out here. Now, I teach a class on subsistence and survival, and I have a couple of students here that are going to school here, and they're working here, and power went off. And so for 3 days, we didn't have power. It just so happens that we had school that week. First time, I've been here for 25 years, first time that I've ever had school scheduled when the power company couldn't provide power for us. And so here we are down here in the classroom, for all of you students who've been here, we're down here in the classroom in the basement now, and there's no power. So there's no light, and so we have to use candles. And we're down here using candles. Now, I had prepared for this. My thinking has been, you know, well, we'll use power. Candle power. That's what we're going to do. We did. And so the two fellows that were here, they said, you know, Gordon, you talk a lot about preparedness, but you weren't prepared at all. The power went out and you don't have a generator. And then, that's not true. Hell, I got three generators here. And I told them, I said, hey, wait a minute, boys. So now I got three generators. Although it is true that none of the three generators work. But I do have three generators, so don't tell me that I'm not prepared. And then one of them had a generator, and he said, well, I'm going to bring my generator over, and we'll hook it up. And I said, well, I plumbed this thing in here. I had an electrician here years ago, about 1988. And he put a gray box on the house, and there's a pigtail hanging down from it. And you got to have just the right kind of fitting. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you know when you're trying to plug in something, you got to have the right kind of fitting to plug in. It ain't like plugging it in the wall. It's got something special there. And we didn't have a pigtail. The electrician never did make me a pigtail because at the time he wired this in, I didn't have a generator. Since then, I bought three generators, but I never did get the pigtail made up. Now the power goes out. We got three generators that don't work. We got a box with a pigtail that we ain't got nothing to plug it into. And this guy, he's running around here looking for a pigtail, and he looked and looked and looked, and he couldn't find one. If he'd asked me, I'd have told him we ain't got one. And if you can find one around here, that'll be a miracle because we never did make one. And he got kind of upset with me, and he said, well, this is really stupid. He said, you're not prepared for this likelihood that the power is going to go out. Well, boys and girls, I've been here 25 years. Now, the power went out for 5 days in 1988. I got to tell you that the White River Valley Electric Co-op here in Ozark County, Missouri, by God, now, those boys are pretty damn good. Now, we've had the power go off here since then. I'm not suggesting to you that the power has never gone off, but it's never gone off for 5 days. Now, it was off here for 5 days. Power. In fact, as I speak, there's people down in Arkansas that's been off for 2 weeks now, and they tell them it's going to be another two. Now, those people are going to be out of power for 30 days, some of them. Not all of them, but some of them. Now, you know, most people got their power back, and ours came back in about 5 days, and it was inconvenient as hell. I got to tell you that when the power goes off, it's inconvenient, but, you know, we had plenty of candles, and we have a gas stove, and we got matches to light the gas stove. We got wood heat. Everything went fine. I thought everything was pretty good. But so one of my guys here, he took, during this period of time, now, we were a little short of things over here. So the boys went out, and when they went out, they brought back 5 gallons of gas. Now, that was good. That was good thinking on their part that they brought back 5 gallons of gas. Because we had to haul water from down here up to the trailer up here on the North 40. And I thought that 5 gallons of gas was a pretty good idea. We put that in the pickup and haul water. So one of the boys took the generator, and he figured out a way to hook it up to his trailer. And he hooked it up, and he started the generator. And he burned up the 5 gallons of gas to burn a 100-watt light bulb for 3 days. And then he said to me, he said, Gordon, you're not very well prepared. And I said, you know, son, electricity is at the bottom of my list. We haven't even prepared for electricity here when the bottom falls out of the economy. And the reason for that is that it costs about 30 cents a kilowatt hour to generate electricity with gasoline. So here's my man up here, took our last 5 gallons of gas, burned it up to burn a 100-watt light bulb for 3 days. And when we got all through, it cost us 30 cents a kilowatt hour to burn up 5 gallons of gas. I didn't need to spend any money to burn up that 5 gallons. Hell, we could have dumped it out on the ground, for crying out loud, and saved ourselves a lot of time, effort, and energy. And then we could carry the water up to the North 40. But the moral to the story is over here that what is likely to happen and what we ought to actually be preparing for consumes our scarce resources, and that the scarce resources ought to be allocated in such a way that you get the most bang for the buck. Now, I've got a list of 100 things here that disappear first when there's an economic collapse or when there's an emergency or the power goes off. And do you know what the number one thing on the list is? Generators. That's the first thing that everybody goes out and buys, is a generator, which I have down here at number 101. I don't even have it on the list. And that's because let's assume that we have a generator and we got the pigtail and everything is scoped out and we're ready to go. What in the hell makes you think that when there's an economic collapse that there's going to be any gasoline for you to buy to put in the generator so that you can burn it up at the rate of 30 cents a kilowatt hour? And assuming that you've got some gasoline, how long is it going to last? Now, the Amish people out here, they've got a solution to this. They don't have any generators, they don't have any light bulbs, and they don't have any wiring in their house, but they got lots of candles. They always have light. They just don't have electric light. So I sat down and I said, all right, we've got a choice here between electric light and candlelight. And the electric light probably cannot be sustained because it's unsustainable. and the candlelight can probably be sustained for years to come. And I told this young fellow, I said, you know, that 5 gallons of gas cost us $10. And we could have accomplished the same thing with one candle for 35 cents. Now, that's what I like about subsistence and survival and planning. You know, have you got an idea as to where these scarce resources need to be put? Now, Franklin Sanders, I thought, hit the nail right on the head. He calls this discontinuities, or continuities, or what's going to continue and then what isn't going to continue. I thought that was a pretty good way to put that. So he starts off with discontinuities. He said, discontinuities, those are events that break the existing system of society, are relatively rare. They are so relatively unlikely that they're not really worth preparing for. For instance, in America, the Revolution, the war between the states, and the Great Depression with the Roosevelt administration were all discontinuities. The Industrial Revolution was a discontinuity. They deeply changed. They certainly did remake institutions, government, and society, no doubt about it. But discontinuities are rare. They are so rare that although we ought to consider and even prepare for them, they should not dominate our thinking. Well, now, I hadn't thought of it that way before. But, you know, that is pretty right. The chances of the Titanic sinking aren't good. You know, ocean liners cross the ocean every day, have for years and years. Once in a while, one of them sinks. No doubt about it. But every time you get on an airliner, while it's true, some of them crash in the Hudson River once in a while. There was one just the other day, landed in the Hudson River. Everybody got off, but ordinarily, when you're riding on an airliner and it lands someplace other than the runway, not very many people walk away from it. Now, every time I get on an airplane, it crosses my mind that this may be the end of my life. Airplanes do crash. But I never made the determination that I wouldn't fly because I was afraid that the airliner was going to crash, although they do from time to time. And, of course, the people that are on them all die, as a rule. The family that flies together dies together. And so Franklin says, but it's a discontinuity. It's not likely to happen and ought not to dominate our planning. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a plan for getting off the Titanic just in case. You know, this is why when you go into a hotel, they got a little sign up on the door and it says, in the event of fire, don't use the elevator, use the stairs. And you should familiarize yourself with where the stairs are, because in a fire, there probably isn't going to be any electric lights. So you may have to be crawling down the hall. Should you be crawling to the right or left when you walk out your door to the exit? So when I go into a hotel, I scope out the exits. And I always try to stay on the lower floors. You know, it's easier for the fire department to get you off the third floor than the 30th floor. So if I've got a choice between the third floor and the 30th, I always take the third. And that's because it's easier to get rescued from the third floor than the 30th. Not to say that it's impossible, you know, to get out of the 30th. The towering inferno, you know, had some survivors. But let's be thinking about that as we're preparing for the future. So the present situation, he says, right now we stand in the midst of the worst financial crisis of the last 400 years. That was a new way of looking at that. I thought this was the worst financial crisis in the last 75 years. That's what I was thinking. Sanders says, nope, it's the worst financial crisis of the last 400 years. I'm glad I read his newsletter, because that gave me something new to think about. And I said, oh my God, Frank, are you sure that's true? 400 years? He says it is. In fact, he asks the question. He says, why do I pick 400 years? He says, because the presently prevailing trend towards centralization began about 1600. That's when national states arose, and it's when feudalism died, when human society and all human relations were fundamentally reorganized. And that's also about the time that central banks, the tool of national economic centralization, first appeared. The Bank of Sweden, 1650s. The Bank of England in 1694. The first great national economic crisis appeared soon after central banks in England in 1696. It was a run on the Bank of England, France in 1720. John Law's Mississippi Company, the bubble, and England about 1720, the South Sea bubble. If any great discontinuity is bearing down upon us, it is the shift from centralizing power to decentralizing. For the next 400 years or so, power will be flowing away from centers and toward localities. But that has occurred, but it'll take 6 to 24 months. So it's a discontinuity which is too slow and too vast to deal with, and we're now seeing its peak, so centralization is not dead yet. It may be dying, but it isn't dead yet. Now, those earlier economic crises were ramped up from local to national panics by the work of central banks. National crises were not possible before central banks because there was no national economy, only local economies. But although these and later crises invade the whole nation, they did not until the Great Depression draw in the whole world. Now the banks have spawned a crisis even more embracing than the Great Depression. It is the worst in 400 years. Globalization has done its ultimate work, and with its failure has now peaked. And although we will be dodging the falling fragments for years to come, so far the U.S. government's response, and I include the government Siamese twin, the Federal Reserve under that term, has been exactly what anyone might have predicted. Likewise, the nature of the crisis has been widely misunderstood, or at any rate, the blame has been placed on the wrong shoulders. The blame for what's going on around us right now is being put on the wrong shoulders. That is the taxpayers. That is the public at large. I thought, now that's quite a statement. The discontinuity that we are about to go into is a world earth-shaking change, probably from centralization, back to regionalization. And it's going to affect you, it's going to affect me and everybody else. But being able to prepare for it, being able to look ahead and allocate our scarce resources so that we're not fighting the last depression of the 1930s, but we're preparing for the next depression, which is the one at hand. I think Franklin Sanders has got a good point. That's called The Money Changer. You can get a copy. Why don't you call him? It's 888-218-9226. That number again, 888-218-9226. And we'll take it up right there next time when we talk about this thing of the discontinuities or the likelihoods. Let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.